fellow pals of mine experienced one of those funny little coincidences yesterday. I was considering the intro for this week's show about medical history, and the first thing that popped up in my brain was that painful mercurochrome from my childhood. Remember that stuff? Oh, it hurt so much. It seemed like you were being punished for scraping that knee or elbow. Well, a buddy on Facebook actually posted a picture of mercurochrome a couple of hours after I was thinking about it. Weirdly random. Anyway, my mercurochrome flashback was due to my interview with Dr. Bob about the Museum of Medical History regarding how far medicine has progressed. Dr. Bob graciously set time out from his busy schedule to provide you a virtual tour of the museum. So I think it's funny that as soon as people walk in the door, there's an iron lung, and you have a little dummy head in there just in case people aren't sure how they're supposed to lie in there, huh?
Right. We actually used to have a mannequin in, but it freaked so many people out that they replaced it with a doll.
Yeah, that's a little disconcerting.
The iron lung was developed in the 1930s, used primarily in the 1940s and 50s, mainly for people suffering from bulbar polio. The bulbar variation of polio prevented their diaphragm from working and also affected their intercostal muscles, the muscles between the ribs, so they could not breathe. And of course, if they couldn't breathe, it would not last very long. So the iron lung was developed and used. People would remain in the iron lung for a matter of weeks sometimes if they recovered. Other people spent their whole lives in an iron lung. Two people have died in the last couple of years that spent at least 50 years in an iron lung.
That recent, though.
Very recently. There's probably maybe 10 to 15 people still in iron lungs in the United States. I haven't seen the figures for the last year or two, but very, very uncommon now. Unfortunately, most of those with bulbar polio have died off. The other type of polio is a type that affected the limbs, and you see pictures of kids with braces and crutches, and they did not have the bulbar type that affected the breathing, so there was no need for them to be put in the iron lung. I'll turn the iron lung on here so you can actually hear it, and you can kind of empathize with what someone had to listen to 24 hours a day for as long as you were in an iron lung.
Oh, man.
And when you add that to the fact that they were limited because only their head was sticking out of the iron lung, so they had to be totally supported by nursing care to feed them, to give them things to drink, for bathing. There were ports on the side of an iron lung that had a rubber gasket around them so it would seal around the wrists and not affect the breathing for the patient. So the nurse could do care and could do bathing through those two ports in the side of the iron lung. There's not many left today. There's maybe 10 or 15 in public display in the United States, as well as we can tell. And we don't know what happened to the other hundreds of thousands, hundreds to thousands of them that were in existence in the 1940s and 1950s.
Well, let's thank Mr. Salk, huh?
Right. And we do have a little video here when we do school groups that tells about the development of the polio vaccine and the March of Dimes. So we'll show that when school groups come in.
Now, I imagine with all of your inventory, you must have it organized in some fashion, or am I assuming?
Well, we try to have the displays following themes in general. And we do have an inventory of all the items, but we try to arrange in themes, and that'll be evident as we kind of walk through the museum. The first case next to the iron lung has a variety of things in it. It has early ways for the patient to do urine and blood sugar levels if they were diabetic before today's fancy little gadgets that give much more accurate results. We also have a variety of things that we use for doing blood counts and hematology work, including the pipettes, which I remember in medical school in the 1960s, you had to actually suck the blood up through these pipettes and put it in the slide and count the number of cells on it, which is all done by computers today. We have some interesting bottles here that are very colorful, but beyond the color, they're embossed on the outside, as you can notice.
Yeah, they're the blue, the cobalt blue bottles.
Right, and some brown. But as you notice, they're all embossed one way or another on the outside. They're poison bottles. So things that people should not take are in these bottles, and therefore, if they got up in the middle of the night before electricity and grabbed a bottle from the medicine chest, just by feel, they could tell that it was a bottle with something in that they should not be taking.
I see there's one that's very specific, the skull and crossbones.
Right.
That's pretty clear.
And then we have some nursing bottles below that, kind of representing the last 50 to 100 years in nursing bottles. We have a little exhibit in homeopathic medication. Of course, the theory of homeopathy was that like cures like, and that a very small amount of a substance, which in a large amount would cause the same symptoms a patient was having, would help cure the patient.
Which is popular today.
Still popular today, definitely. And then the case next door is primarily patent medicines. Now, patent medicines were never patented, because if they were patented, they'd have to reveal what was in them, which they didn't want to do. And then the 1906 Federal Drug and Food Act came upon us, and that prevented selling items that did not have products listed, particularly dangerous products like heroin and cannabis and opium.
Dr. Goodall.
Here are some really interesting labels on a lot of these, and we've organized the patent medicines according to the body system that they were used for: respiratory, kidneys, digestive, neurological, etc. And we've got hundreds of other bottles that we don't have in display.
Well, this is interesting, a glycerin extract of red bone marrow.
Right. There are a variety of old things that contained bone marrow, blood cells, etc. That's an interesting one, too. That is a wine that contained cocaine from the 1800s. Mariani wine.
Whatever happened to Mariani?
I'm not sure.
So you have, looks like personal
bedpans. We have a lot of bedpans, but these are our classier bedpans going back to the 1890s. And they're all different, all kind of unique, including one that actually has instructions on it as to how to use it.
But that is porcelain, isn't it?
They're all like porcelain.
And they're different shaped, different designs.
Mm-hmm. And we have a couple trusses that were used to hold hernias in, when they could not do surgery or before surgery was fairly safe to do. In a bottle right in front of it, a liquid pad medicine that claimed that it cures ruptures.
For only that easy, huh? So some of these ingredients are interesting. Veratrum viride, ergo. What are those exactly?
Well, we've got a number of reference books that we have to look at usually for most of these. We do have an index up here for a number of the things that were around in the 1800s, telling basically what was in them, like lupulin was from humulus, lupulus, or hops, prescribed as a sedative and to settle the stomach.
Well, beer can be a sedative, that's for sure. That looks like an old medical book.
That's an old anatomy book from about 1850. We've got about 1,000 textbooks in our museum, from mainly the mid-1800s to the early 1900s, a couple going back to the 1700s. But we've got some really, really beautiful anatomy books from the mid-1800s. Here's a collection of old eyeglasses and new eyeglasses. Probably the most interesting one is something that was developed in the last decade or so called adaptive eye care. And it's a pair of eyeglasses that has two membranes with a silicone liquid between them. You can put the glasses on someone in a third world country and inject or remove some of the silicone between the two lenses until they can see clearly, and then they've got a pair of glasses that they can use without the need to see an ophthalmologist or an optometrist. So it's been a tremendous boon in third world countries, helping people with visual problems. Got some old hearing aids from the old tube type to one from about the 1930s. That you'd have to carry around your neck in a large box.
I've seen in old movies.
Right. And here we have just a variety of eye items, including a beautiful kit with the different lenses. When the opticians used those by hand instead of a machine to automatically change the lenses.
What is this in this box that has all these different colored yarn?
Okay, that was for testing for color blindness.
Okay.
There's also books like the one down here for testing, but that was one of the early ways of testing for color blindness.
Simple.
It was colored yarns, very simple. Here we have some respirators, a Bennett and the Bird which were very common in the 60s, 70s, 80s. Variations are still used today. They would require that a tube be put in the throat in order to use them in someone who is unconscious. They also sometimes are used just to drive medicines for asthma into the lungs by creating positive pressure.
And you've even got the chairs, the equipment for the patient back there, it looks like.
Right, we have a beautiful examining table back there and an ear, nose, and throat chair. And
is that an old wheelchair stuck in the...
There is an old... We've got about four old wheelchairs. There's one hidden away here. This is a cloth covered. We have a couple of others, including some beautiful caned ones. And again, they'd be probably circa 1930s, 1940s. And here, as we go down the hallway, is a case with kind of a wide variety of items in it. One of the more interesting is a bottle of soothing syrup for infants and babies who are having teething problems. And of course, the main ingredient in it was morphine and alcohol. Laudanum, which was a tincture of opium, was also fairly common back in the 1800s. We have a display of stamps, commemorative stamps related to the history of medicine. We have an exhibit on rattlesnakes with an actual preserved rattlesnake and some of the kits that were used, which are no longer used for rattlesnake bites.
Just to see what it says here, dried rattlesnake used as medicine in Mexico. Rattlesnake is ground up and added to food or taken in capsule form for various disorders, including skin problems.
Well, the rattlesnakes always peel theirs off, so.
Right.
I like how this little, this small display says, take two and call me in the morning, with various aspirins over the decades.
Right.
It's very cute.
Hasn't changed much there. Here we have a skeleton in the wooden box that was used in medical school in Britain, and an interesting vertical unit next to it that is a blood oxygenator. It was used primarily in the early days of developing blood oxygenators for open heart surgery. Top shelf is different spring waters that all had, they claim, all had health benefits to them.
That one called Red Raven almost looks like a beer label.
It does. And then Witter Springs, which was, I believe, from California.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
A positive remedy for stomach, liver, kidney, and bladder troubles. And remedy, so that probably was after 1906. Before 1906, a lot of the items were called cures, and then they made the requirement that people could no longer say these cured a disease, but they could use the term remedy. I have a couple of official-looking badges here. One was worn by physicians in the health department, and the other was a medical examiner's badge.
I want to note this one bottle, Magpotine, ocean water concentrated and purified, an unsurpassed mineral water, nature's laxative.
And we've got a whole case of laxatives next door here. They were probably the most common medicament back.
I mean, I love the ocean, but I never thought of it as a... So we got tools of a pharmacist.
Right, there's several items for making suppositories. And we've got a pill roller at the bottom, which is when they had to create their own pills. Of course, now everything comes from the pharmaceutical industry in bottles, and they just have to be counted out. But back in the 1800s and early 1900s, a lot of the medicines had to be made, including digitalis, had to be made and eluted out drop by drop.
Now, what is this book on top? Is that just a receipt?
That's a pharmacy prescription book. There are a variety of ways, and we'll see more as we get into the museum proper, of putting the original prescription in by the pharmacist, so you could maintain the records. Now we have our skeleton, which preceded me. I've been involved at the Medical Society with the Historical Committee here for well over 30 years. We have an interesting item called the Raytheon Microtherm Unit. It was noticed that when they were developing tubes for radar during the war, that the people working there could get deep heat treatments by being close to the radar. So they developed in the late 1940s a unit that was the first generator of this type to be used for the heating of human tissues. So basically for rheumatism and different problems like that, this would create a way of creating heat deep in the tissues. Over here we have some other units, a metabulator, which was used for determining the basal metabolic rate, not used essentially anymore. Its use was partly to determine the thyroid function. Today, a simple blood test gives you extremely accurate reads on the thyroid function, but before that was available, they had to infer it on the basis of your basic metabolic rate or by the speed of your reflexes, and this reflexometer was an example of that, where you'd kneel down, they'd tap your ankle, you'd have the foot reflex, and they'd measure the speed of the reflex. And if you're high thyroid, it'd be fast. If you're low thyroid, it would be slow. So another way of determining thyroid function before the days of blood tests. We have a hemodynamagnetometer, which was basically a quackery item used by the chiropractors back in the early 1900s.
Well, it does say down here, instrument for experimental research only.
Right, the other one did not, so they were used actually for treatment. They hooked the patient up with different wires, and by the color of the light that shone from back of the console, they claimed they could not only make a diagnosis, but actually treat people with it. Here we have, and there's a common thing in a lot of these old instruments, they're in beautiful wooden cases, and that's actually part of the reason I bought this one, because it was such a gorgeous piece. And it's a Fisher diathermy machine. Again, it's used to produce deep heat in tissues, which is used still in physical therapy today for therapy, but also when you read through the book that came with that, it was used for treating a variety of cancers and everything. Other things which, of course, it was not effective for. Here we have a nice collection of mechanical heart valves. One of the more effective mechanical heart valves was developed in Sacramento by Dr. Smiloff in combination with Sac State and the Sutter Research Institute. And a lot of these are Dr. Smiloff's valves that he developed at Sac State. And eventually they were contracted out to Cutter Laboratories to produce. A lot of the others are unrelated to his valves, but they were valves that they examined to find out what was good and what was bad about the other valves that were in the market so they could try to develop a very effective and very safe one. Again, we have a lot of books. We have a little transcribing machine here. We have a dictaphone at the other end using a cylinder like you'd see in the very early 1900s. There was an orthopedist that actually used this in his practice, I believe, until about the 1960s, however.
That late. It's a long photo. Who's that of?
That is from the 51st Evacuation Hospital. This was in World War II, and it was staffed primarily by physicians and medical personnel from Sacramento, and it was overseas, and it was kind of a mobile hospital, but very, very important in providing medical care during the war. Here we have a variety of things, including some obstetric instruments, and some of the instruments that were used before the days of cesarean section when they had to sacrifice the infant in order to save the mother. We have some heel bone fractures that were not healed ideally, as you can see just by looking at them, even without a medical background. We have dental tools, including the turnkeys that were used for pulling teeth, and apparently they had a different design for almost every tooth in the mouth of the turnkeys. We used to have live leeches here, but they were very intensive as far as care. You had to change their water about every 2 to 3 days. We don't have a volunteer to do that at this point, so we got some preserved leeches. But
that is a piece of medical information I didn't see coming.
But leeches were used, of course, in the 1800s as one of the modes of bleeding.
Right.
You know, they felt basically that bleeding would cure a lot of diseases. That was going back to Hippocrates and the humoral theory, where there are four humors in the body, black bile, yellow bile, phlegm, and blood, and by changing the balance of those, it could change the health of the patient. So they're still used today, leeches are, but they're used by plastic surgeons to decompress areas that are swelling up with too much blood after they've done some work. For instance, if they reattach an ear, they can attach the vessels to get blood into the ear so it survives, but to get the blood out of the ear, nature takes a while to create those pathways. So if it swells up too much, it's going to sacrifice the ear. So by the use of leeches, they'll remove a teaspoon or two of blood and inject an anticoagulant that allows bleeding for a day or two and prevent the loss of that appendage that was put back on.
And the maggots?
The maggots? Again, maggots were not used specifically medical medically in the Gold Rush era, but they were common. Anyone who had an open wound and was outside had a good chance of developing maggots in the wound, which would clean the wound as well as almost anything we can do today for a wound. So they were natural things that were used. Today, they're actually by prescription. If someone has a wound that is very difficult to clean by all traditional medicine today, you can actually order a bottle of sterile maggots that are not invasive, and by that I mean there are flies like down in Central America that will invade and burrow in the skin and lay their eggs under the skin. These are non-invasive, they're hygienic, and they're put on a wound in a hospital in patients and do a beautiful job cleaning the wound. So they're also used today yet, but a little different modality than they were in the 1800s.
Some of these books are seriously old.
Yeah, a lot of them are mid-1800s, and they're fascinating to read through. You know, for instance, if you look at heart disease in one of the old books, you hardly see anything about arteriosclerotic heart disease, you know, today's major problem, because people didn't tend to live long enough to develop major problems back then. So they're mainly rheumatic fever, which we don't see today because of antibiotics, which they did not have back then. So you really see the trends of medicine by looking at some of these old textbooks.
Well, you've got a photo here, or an illustration, I should say, the barber's room, a 19th century English print showing the barber performing surgery.
Right. Actually, the surgeons in England developed from the barbers, which were called the barber surgeons. And next to it, we have a barber pole. It's one of the few barber poles without blue on it. I'm assuming that was kind of a patriotic thing to add to barber poles in the U.S. This is red and white. And that red and white barber pole represented the old barber surgeon, because he would have his white gauze and white cloth full of blood that he'd hang on the line to dry. And, of course, that was red and white. And that's how the red and white barber pole developed.
And what is this little triangle
this
shape?
This is called a nervometer, and all our research on the internet has not come up with any information on it, but again, it probably was a quackery item. Here we have an exhibit on radiology. We have the first X-ray tube in Sacramento from 1897. I'm amazed that it survived this long. Behind it is a bill of sale for the tube, and to the right is a picture of Dr. Fay in his office, and you see a large blocks to the right, that's a static electricity generator that you would turn to power the X-ray tube. So that's within the first year of when X-rays came out. So Sacramento was really in the forefront using X-rays at that point. Of course, the physicians did not realize the danger of X-rays. Here's a glass X-ray plate from about 1910, about 13 years after this X-ray tube, and it took a half an hour of holding still to get an X-ray of the shoulder at that point. And, of course, sometimes a radiologist would help hold the patient in place, getting radiation to his hand at the same time. So cancers of the hand were not uncommon in early radiologists. We also have the fluoroscopes, handheld fluoroscopes, which would be used in lieu of taking a picture onto a glass plate. The physician would hold it up, look through the glass. The X-ray would be behind the patient, and he'd actually be able to see the X-ray image on the plate in the handheld fluoroscope. And if anyone remembers the old shoe stores in the 1950s, when you'd step up and put your feet in the little compartment and look through it, and you could see your bones and therefore how your shoe was fitting, that was basically a fluoroscope that was embedded with an X-ray unit beneath where you put your feet. And for obvious reasons, they're not used anymore. This next case is all devoted to Chinese medicine. Of course, the Chinese were very prominent in building not only the railroads but the levees in the 1800s. We had a number of Chinese doctors back in that era and Chinese herbalists. And we have on the top some of the new machinery that's been used over the last 30 or 40 years in conjunction with acupuncture. And in the case itself, we see things going back to the mid-1800s as far as different medicines that were used and also the different herbs that were used. For instance, we have flying squirrel feces, which were used for menstrual disorders. We have cattail pollen, known as puhuang. We have maowang, which is basically ephedrine, which was used by a Chinese herbalist to save Governor Stanford's wife when she had a severe respiratory problem. So this pays respect to the Chinese medicine that has obviously been around for thousands of years and has been really very effective for a lot of conditions. Here we have our little dental corner. We have a foot-operated dental drill and a dental chair and a beautiful wooden case, which I'll open and you can see all the dental tools in there and all kinds of dials and gauges above. This probably was shortly after 1900, we suspect. We haven't been able to document the information of that yet.
So electric drills.
Yeah, they were powered by a generator down here.
So I can see the dials so they can
adjust the pressure of the generator and the air pressure.
Oh, so you've got a little chart here on the rates, doctor rates.
Right, ordinary office visit was $2.50. This was probably about 1860, I would think. We don't have an exact date on it, but roughly that era. Night visits from $5 to $10. Vaccination, $2.50.
I like this one. Surgical operations. Special cases and all detentions will be charged extra, as may be agreed upon. Oh, they still got to negotiate their fee back then.
Beautiful dental cabinet and a portable x-ray machine from World War II, a military issue. Here we have a cautery unit. Obviously would not be used in an operating today, a room today, because it's all wooden. You need things today that can be sterilized and made hygienic, so you don't tend to see wood in operating rooms at all now. These are all instruments for looking into the body, either through little teeny slits or through natural openings in the body. We have two sigmoidoscopes, the new flexible one, and the old non-flexible one, which was just a stainless steel tube that was about 12 to 15 inches long that would be inserted to look at the sigmoid colon. We also have laparoscopic surgical instruments, which are used currently to do surgery through several small incisions in the abdomen. We have cystoscopes. They were used to look up into the bladder through the urethra. And here we have some little cases featuring patent medicines and tuberculosis. One has one of the miniature x-rays that when I was a kid, I remember in the 50s, 60s, and back in the 40s, a truck would come around and do these little miniature chest x-rays checking for tuberculosis.
It's a pretty nice looking microscope there. It looks brass.
Got quite a microscope collection on the other side here. That's probably, I would think, late 1800s. And here we have an anesthesia machine that would be representative of what was used probably in the 1960s, 1970s. This is a case devoted to nurses with a variety of things, such as little sterilizers for needles and syringes, needle sharpeners, a bunch of gauze up at the top. The gauze was used to see if a needle needed sharpening. They just dragged the needle across the gauze, and if it caught a thread, they knew that it needed to be sharpened. Fortunately, today, you hardly feel your hypodermic needles when you get an injection, because they're all disposable and all extremely small and sharp.
Well, that's assuming the nurse knows how to insert it. I've had a couple of bad experiences. So I like this Florence Nightingale lamp.
And a little reproduction. We've got a poster in Florence Nightingale out we can see in the way out done by a student for History Day last year.
Oh, nice.
This is our surgical case. On top, we have a wooden support for a fractured leg, probably about 1890. We have a variety of metal and old wooden splints. We have some of our Civil War amputation kits. We have three of them in the museum.
That's what this is right here with the saw?
Right.
God, I can't even begin to imagine. I understand, though, is that saved a lot of lives, because before that, it was pretty much...
Right. If you had a compound fracture, meaning a fracture where the bone stuck through the skin, because there are no antibiotics, the mortality rate would be generally 100% from infection. The mortality rate of amputation was about 50%. So you're able to save about half the people by amputation. And then it has other items in it, too. It has a little interesting saw that looks like a hatchet. That's a bone saw that was used in the skull. There's a trephine there with a black handle, and that's used for removing a skull, a circular piece of skull. If there were an injury with blood accumulating on top of the brain, you'd need to relieve that pressure. So you'd use one of these little core-type devices just to remove a plug of bone.
And then you have a tonsil snare.
Well, tonsillotomes and tonsil snares.
That's a good visual.
Look like something you might use to get an olive out of a
bottle. Yeah, exactly. Snare.
There were two types of instruments used for removing tonsils, which obviously was fairly common back when I was a kid.
But when you use the word snare, it sounds like you just grab it and then you're yanking. Is that basically
no,
what they
No, a snare doing? Basically would have a wire in that would constrict and cut the base of the tonsil.
Okay, good.
Here we have a variety of things. We have two blood transfusion kits, and this is when blood transfusions were done directly from one person to another. We've got some gigantic gallstones that had to be awfully uncomfortable for the patient.
Yeah, that's huge.
Some beautiful ivory handle surgical instruments. A lot of those were used for eye surgery, very, very delicate.
Yeah, circumcision clamp, bone biopsy. And it's a silver urinary catheter.
Were they other types besides silver?
Well, it was made out of sterling silver. I'm not sure why. You know, of course, they're all made now out of stainless steel type material.
We had some metal splints and wooden splints.
Wooden splints.
And I like this ear, nose, and throat case. It looks like a sewing case. All those
right.
drawers coming out.
With a whole variety of instruments, sometimes wicked-looking instruments.
Yes, wicked being the key word. Exercising in bed chart. That looks like Houdini almost.
Sanford Bennett created this chart, and you know, exercises that could still be used today.
They certainly can. I recognize a few.
And this is part of our book collection, of course. We still have a number of medical journals. We've got rid of most of them just because of space and the fact they're available online now, but we still have some of the significant medical journals, some going back to the late 1800s, early 1900s.
And you have the old doctor cases up above the books there.
We have many, many doctor's bags. You must have 30, 40, 50 of them, somewhere in that ballpark. And almost every one is different from the other one. Some opened and had compartments in the top. Some were like little handbags. They really varied quite a bit depending upon era and use. Back here we have the rest of our bedpan collection. These are primarily the glass and the metal ones, not quite as impressive as the beautiful porcelain ones up front.
What's that blue, dark blue jacket with the Red Cross symbol on it?
That is a medical, and I'm not sure, it looks like it's maybe German, with the Red Cross. It would be a medic that would have worn that, but I'm not sure of the history of it. Then we have some pictures on the wall from an album of about 50 that show cutaneous or skin manifestations of different diseases. And of course about 70 or 80% of those are either tuberculosis or syphilis, so it gives you an idea of how we've evolved over the years.
Is that a stretcher in the corner?
Yeah, that's an old Red Cross type stretcher. Yeah.
And this is like a, just from the old movies, this looks like a nurse's uniform with the cape.
Right, this is from Children's Hospital in San Francisco, the nice uniform and the blue cape. We've got a number of different nurses' uniforms around here. There's one over here that actually was, again, a Red Cross nurse's uniform. This is an X-ray machine from about the 1920s, portable X-ray machine. This is a beautiful oak exam table, mainly an OBGYN examining table with a large porcelain basin for irrigation. There is a dictaphone part of the other unit that's up front, which is a transcriber. Here is a nursing uniform from Sacramento Junior College School of Nursing in the 1950s, which was a program that was related to Sacramento County Hospital at that time.
Preserving the dead.
Yes, it's a box that contained a bottle of preservative for preserving people. In fact, I've got in the back of a doctor's roster recipe for preserving embalming fluid, and it testified that it was used in this person who was shipped by wagon to the railroad and by railroad to the east, and they arrived in perfect shape. And of course some of the common ingredients back then in embalming fluids were arsenic and phenol or carbolic acid. Another wheelchair, and in this wheelchair we have Mrs. Chase.
This is a wicker wheelchair.
This is a wicker wheelchair. And Mrs. Chase was an early teaching mannequin for nurses. This is probably from about the 1940s. It's the second model that they developed. Mrs. Chase was a doll maker whose husband was a physician and said, "Dear, do you think you could create a large doll for teaching nurses because they're tired of using straw-stuffed mannequins?" So you can see a tracheostomy hole, and you can see how it would have been used for teaching bandaging and also colostomy care and dressings.
Safety pins.
And So we're real happy to get this. It's a really unique piece. And a contrast with today's mannequins. If you have not seen the mannequins used today for training, one mannequin can run $100,000. They actually, some cry, some sweat. They have heartbeats. You can do injections in them, and it'll let you know whether you're using the wrong medication or the right medication. They're absolutely amazing. They almost totally replicate a real patient, and they're phenomenal for training. So come a long way since Mrs. Chase.
Thank you, Mrs. Chase.
Here we have something about infectious disease and antibiotics. We have a shelf that has a lot of penicillins and sulfas and quinines going back over the last 100-plus years. Some current antibiotics. We've got an interesting-looking item with gauges in a wooden box at the bottom that was a pneumothorax machine. That was used in treating tuberculosis before the days of antimicrobial therapy for tuberculosis. One way of treatment was by injecting air into the pulmonary cavity to compress the lung so the lung would not be used in that side. And resting the lung, they felt, would help the lung recover. So the pneumothorax machine was a way of gauging the amount of air to put into a chest cavity to collapse a lung. We have a little display in Weimar, which is up in Placer County, and it was a TB sanitarium for a long time up there. We have a flu mask, probably from the era of 1918-1919, a homemade flu mask. We have O'Dwyer's larynx tubes and an antitoxin syringe, both of which kind of bring up the subject of diphtheria. Diphtheria kill kids in one of two ways, either with a toxin or with a pseudomembrane that formed across the breathing apparatus, across the trachea, so they couldn't breathe. So the O'Dwyer's tubes were a way of opening that membrane so the infant or the child could breathe again. And of course, the antitoxin syringe was used to inject antitoxin. We have a variety of other things below, some of the early syphilis treatments when they're using organic arsenic to treat syphilis. Some EKG machines. This was one of the most common, and I say that in the base that we've inherited about six of those. They're in a beautiful mahogany cabinet, and again, they'd probably be 1950s, 1960s. This one to the left is earlier, and it actually did the image in photographic paper as opposed to a heated stylus and a piece of paper. Here we have diagnostic tools. We have a wide variety of stethoscopes. Every one is almost different from the one next to it. We also have blood pressure gauges, one going back to about 1900. We have a variety of percussion hammers and the kind of things that would be used in the office to help make diagnoses. We also have a couple of the old treatment items here. The fleams, which looked like a pocket knife, they were used to cut into a vein and let the blood run out from the vein as far as bleeding. Bleeding was one of the four modalities often used in the 1800s. Bleeding, cupping, puking, and purging were four of the common modalities. A glass cup was used for cupping. They'd put a little piece of material in there, light it in fire, which when they put it in the skin, the fire would go out, which would create a vacuum and create a suction. This is a scarificator. The scarificator is a spring-operated instrument that would make between 8 and 12 incisions in the skin, again for bleeding, and it was spring-operated, so all the blades would at one time incise the skin for bleeding. We have an exanthematic remedy. They felt that if you could distract the cause of the disease from one part of the body to another part of the body, you might help the patient. And this was a wooden rod. At one end were multiple needles, and it was activated by a rubber band. So you'd put it in the skin, lift it up, release it, and it would make multiple punctures in the skin. But next door, we have a little variety, almost a third of this case is
hygienic
all laxatives.
Crackers.
All laxatives, including a beautiful brass enema kit. So this shows a focus on the bowels in the early 1900s. We have another surgical kit, another Civil War amputation-type surgical kit with more instruments in it, and a spindle of prescriptions, another way that the prescriptions were saved by the pharmacist.
And they're large circular pieces of paper. So it almost looks like a log.
Yeah, just with a wires thread through the center of them, and they'd be hung up. We have a German obstetrical instrument kit, a couple of other types of instruments here, a microcapillary reader, which is something I got very familiar with when I was in medical school and interning. It was a way of rapidly checking the hematocrit or the red blood count or hematocrit of a patient by putting a little blood in a capillary tube.
spinning it down in a centrifuge, putting it in this unit, and you could read the percent of red cells versus a serum.
So it looks like you have a little mystery here with this inscribed ulna balloon. Huh?
Yes, that has some images that, you know, make you think of maybe South America, and we have no idea whether it was a bone that was inscribed thousands of years ago or whether it was a medical student's project to try to replicate one.
Early graffiti?
Right. We have bitter bottles. Bitters were very common medicines of the early 1900s. They had high concentrations of alcohol. We have Watts liver and kidney bitters. We have Hostetter's stomach bitters. We have Lash's kidney and liver bitters. And again, they were high in alcohol with herbs in them. Of course, bitters today, we think about adding to our Manhattan and drinks. And these are some of the current bitters you can buy. Here again are a few more of the instruments that were used for bleeding and cupping, including another scarificator that's a beautiful brass cube, much more artistic than the one in the other cabinet. Regarding the flute, this was an exhibit by three girls from Elk Grove about 6-7 years ago. It was an entry into History Day, which is a yearly competition of kids. It's coming up March 7th this year in 2015, and this won second place in national.
Talking about the Spanish flu epidemic.
This was a Spanish flu epidemic of 1918-19. This is kind of the gold standard of exhibits. I've never seen one that even has come close to this since this one was done.
Oh, it's very impressive, very well done.
In addition to what you see here, there was about an 80-page bibliography and a DVD interviewing people whose family had died from the flu of 1918-1919. So a very timely thing now. CASE is basically pathology and microscopes. Microscopes going back to probably the mid-1800s. A beautiful slide kit from 1889. And actually, here is a photograph of one of the slides in there. That is an encysted trichinella, which is, you know, found in pork. Fortunately, because of good feeding of pigs now, you don't tend to see trichinosis today. But in the early days when pigs were fed garbage and all, eating raw pork or undercooked pork could cause trichinosis. And this is actually an image from an 1889 slide to show how well those pathology slides have been preserved. Here we have some things from a zoology collection from a physician who died a number of years back. They're from his zoology courses in the 1930s, including some animal fetuses and variety of intestinal worms, particularly Ascaris, roundworms. This is a new item we got. I have to do a label for that. It's a stapler used in surgery for stapling as opposed to suturing a wound. This is all quackery and a variety of things. We have a lot of violet ray machines. We must have a dozen of units like that. When you plug them in, they create a violet color in the glass tube, and you put it directly in the skin, and they claim it would cure a whole variety of conditions. If you wanted a little more effect, you'd hold it 1/8 inch above the skin, and it would zap a spark to the skin. So very, very, very common. You could buy those in the 1900s through Sears, Ward's, Montgomery Ward's. They had them in their catalogs, so they were readily available. Then we have magnetic-type instruments where we'd turn a wheel to cause a magnetic generation. We have the Wilshire electric belt that you would put around you and plug into the wall, developed by the same person Wilshire Boulevard is named after.
And what purpose did that serve?
It would cure arthritis and a whole variety of problems. They claimed it was a magnetic field that created around your body.
Electrate mechanical heart.
Yeah, no relation to heart, basically. It shows how it was used. Again, it was used for local treatment of muscular problems. And it does make your hair stand up a little bit. We have a working model, and I did try it.
Well, would it be similar to ultrasound? Like a vibration?
No,
or something?
No. Created electricity, and it may have worked because so many things, you know, of stimulating the nerves do reduce pain now.
That's what I was
thinking. It may have worked. Then we have some images up there of radioactive items that were used, a Revigator that was developed in San Francisco. It was a large porcelain unit that was coated inside with radium ore and recommended that you fill it with water and drink the water daily from it. And there's another radioactive medication that was sold by a group in Placer County many, many years ago.
Now we got whiskey.
This case is devoted to medicines, top shelf for all embossed bottles from old pharmacies in Sacramento, probably late 1900s, early 1900s. The shelf you're looking at is Prohibition, and they're the only Prohibition liquor bottles I've ever seen that still have the doctor's prescription on the bottle. And the one prescription says 1 tablespoon in water when in distress. And underneath are some of the forms that we use for writing prescriptions for medicinal liquor during Prohibition. We have an old typewriter there that had the pharmacy symbols on it that would be used for typing labels in the pharmacy. We have a variety of cases containing vials of medications, which are typical of what the physician would carry with him when he made house calls, again, in the 1800s and early 1900s. We have the little small vials, which were hypodermic pills, before the days of being able to get your injectables in a sterile glass vial. You'd take a caps or a pill from one of those vials, dissolve it with a little heat in a spoon and water, and then you'd inject that. And then we have some of the common medicaments of the 1800s, particularly mercury, strychnine, and arsenic, three of the very common things. As you can see, this one contained arsenic, strychnine, and capsium, which is red pepper.
And what is the fourth ingredient?
Alloin. I'm not sure what that is.
Even the doctor doesn't know what that
is. We've got our reference books, and there's hundreds, if not thousands, of names like that that we'd love to have volunteers to look up for us. And then we've got another case of a whole variety of patent medicines, including some from Lydia Pinkham.
And who's that?
Lydia Pinkham was famous for making medicines for women, for women's complaints. And in fact, they're still available out of the country 10, 15 years ago. I'm not sure if they still are, but she had a whole variety.
It says vegetable compound. That sounds reasonably healthy.
Well,
except for the 13.5% alcohol.
She took some of her formulas, I think, from the eclectics. There were a number of different types of doctors in Sacramento during the gold rush. There were the homeopaths, the hydrotherapists, the Thompsonians, and the eclectics. They all had different theories about causes of disease, and they were known as the irregular physicians, whereas the regular MDs, like we'd see today, were known as the regular physicians. And in fact, the Medical Society, which is the oldest in the state, 1868 is when our Medical Society here developed, was developed partly to kind of save the community from these irregular physicians. And you see some Hoover's powders, probably occasionally at some of the movies you hear about headache powders, and some of the medicines were in little envelopes, and they were a powdered form, like Crown powders and Hoover's powders.
Lucky Tiger, made for hair and scalp.
So again, we've got hundreds and hundreds of bottles that aren't on display that we need to go through. And the hope is we can photograph the labels and the interesting ones and put them up on our website.
Now this is pretty vague. I like the name of it, Oil of Joy. So it says, use externally, rub on affected parts. For rectal irritations, apply with cotton. Oil of joy.
Any marketing thought that they had, you'll see reflected in these old patent medicines.
They're still doing that today. So you pretty much covered the gambit, it seems.
Yeah, kind of a quick walk through.
With all the high rising costs and accessibility, we got a little spoiled, I think, in some respects.
Yeah, we have, and that's, you know, one advantage of a museum like this. It shows you how far we've come in a relatively short period of time. In fact, it's logarithmic, you know, just in the last couple of years. It's amazing what's happened compared to the 5 or 10 or 15 years before that.
By the way, Dr. Bob is not only the curator of the Museum of Medical History, but he's also heavily involved with the Sac Area History Network, Sacramento County Historical Society, Sacramento History Foundation, Sacramento Association of Museums, Old City Cemetery Committee, Sacramento County Cemetery Advisory Commission, California Historic Cemetery Alliance, and East Lawn Memorial Park. If you've considered volunteering in your committee, historical societies would love your help. Do something different. Start a yo-yo club.